for tuning in to The Queer Truth, the podcast that takes on a variety of topics from pop culture to everyday life. I'm Chantel C. You can call me CC, and I'm joined by my partner in organizing, Denise. Denise, what's up?
Hello. Hello. All the things are happening. Yes, all the things.
All the things. You know, it's been an interesting week. It has been. And of course, I would like to start with shade because that's who I am. So I'm sure the whole world knows by now that your buddy, the person you like to defend,
ooh,
and you have had so many opportunities to defend her this year.
What are you talking about?
Azalea Banks.
Oh, stop. Now, just because I understand Black girl pain does not mean I excuse Black girl bullshit. Okay, so let's be clear.
For those of you who may have missed out, Azalea Banks was invited to a party at Russell Crowe's Beverly Hills hotel suite. RZA invited her there. And because they've been working together, she's been hitting him up for money, for plane tickets, for record deals, and he's been coming through on all of it.
Apparently, by his word, and I need to be down with RZA because I have some things I need to get in order. So can I get a phone number?
Okay. The thing is, like, RZA did disappoint me recently with his, he was on some New Black-ish recently. Yeah. Well, okay. I mean, obviously, if he is like, you know, him and Quentin are very tight. Quentin worships the ground that RZA walks on, had him write the whole score for Kill Bill. If you can work with a dude like Quentin and not had no issues, you got to be on a little bit of a New Black something. Anyway, I do believe that RZA was as generous as he writes in his post.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the point. Azalea gets to the party. Apparently things are going well at first. And then maybe one drink too many, who knows? She starts threatening people, making jokes about cutting them with glass, then picks up a glass like she's about to throw it and gets held up by Russell. Now, Russell's a big boy. He's had a lot of fight scenes in movies. I'm pretty sure he can handle his own. He throws her out.
And spits on her, allegedly.
Spits on her, allegedly calls her the N-word. No one can verify that part. TMZ is on the hunt, though, for that hotel video footage.
Yo, TMZ better than the police. I need to get... I feel like all police killings should be reviewed by an independent counsel at TMZ, I think. I don't know. Like, they just, they get all the evidence, don't they?
All the evidence. What Damn. Do we make of this, though? Because other reports said that she was the one who was throwing around the N-word, which would not surprise me.
Mm-hmm.
But, and then she goes, and rather than, like, being big about it and going to RZA and saying, you know, this happened at the hotel party, let's let that be a separate situation from this record deal that you're helping me out with. Because according to him, he lets everyone speak for themselves. He wasn't worried about the hype. He's heard that she's volatile, but he was still ready to put his neck out for her. She cancels it. Not to mention the fact that she announced she had signed a contract before she signed a contract. Now she's canceled it.
I don't know if she had much of a choice. According to RZA's report, the people that he was hooking her up with for the record deal was like, no, this is a mess. We're not going to do this anymore. So her... saying she canceled it.
Nah, that's not what he wrote. He wrote he had to be the buffer. But he didn't say anything about they were backtracking at that point.
Okay. All right. So D on reading comprehension, I'll go reread that because maybe I was like looking into it a little bit too much. It didn't seem like it was any more of a possibility for her. But he called her out on, or at least he sort of revealed the fact that she, you know, put some stuff out there that she really hadn't firm yet, and that he let that happen because according to him he wasn't trying to mess up her hustle,
right.
And this is who you want to be down with, because I'm not like a massive fan, but he has really parlayed some rap verses into a massive career.
Yes.
He's on movies, he's everywhere, you don't hear stuff about him. He has his stuff together, and that's how you want to do it. He has a career. But I feel like RZA could go to Walmart and nobody would know, right? Like, you would have to be really in the know to be like, is your RZA up in the electronic goods section? Like, what? So that's the kind of career, in my eyes, that is ideal. You're making your money, you're doing what you need to do, but no one is checking for you on Page Six. That's wonderful. So that would have been a really good direction for her to go in. He said he advised her to come up off of social media. I really feel that there's some undertones to this case that I don't love. I don't love the fact that something went down. There was a brother, there was a sister in there, and she ends up in a situation that's volatile. It's her words against this like white man who's famous. His Russell Crowe's friends came out right away. And they were like, absolutely not. She was absolutely in the wrong. He did nothing wrong. She was threatening people, whatever, whatever. I feel like that would have been enough. I don't know if RZA had to say anything.
But RZA wasn't really saying much about the situation. The bulk of his post was, look, I don't really use social media like that. I don't even care about all the rumors and this and that. But this time I feel it appropriate to respond. And I understand that because the long list of things that he did for her before mm-hmm. she made it to that hotel room. And I'm not even saying like, oh, RZA is amazing or this and that. It's not even about owing him something, but the decency and respect that you should have. And you know you have to have in the industry, especially. You cannot burn every bridge and expect to have a career. And continue to make the same mistakes. And that's what I see her doing.
Yeah, it's clear to me, especially if she's hitting up people for money, if that is true, as RZA wrote, this is going to be sad because clearly she's not going, Azealia Banks shouldn't need money, right? Like, in my estimation, she shouldn't mm-hmm. need money. And if she needs money now, what's going to happen after she burns through absolutely all of those bridges? The whole situation is sad because I feel like the hypervisibility of Azealia Banks due to her talent and then also due to her outrageous behavior and her own putting herself in the spotlight and refusing to come off of 10 means that we are witnessing a breakdown of sorts in real time. In ways that are just very sad to me.
But why hasn't anyone staked an intervention? That's what I'm wondering. Does she not have any real friends?
I think that she's functional enough that a common intervention wouldn't be very successful. She has a supposedly play mom or really good friend in Kola Booth who has spoken about this, right? And Kola Booth has her own issues, is a very controversial character in her own right. But she tried to advise Azealia Banks against lightening her skin and had all the good reasons about why she shouldn't do that. And Azealia was like, nah, I got to do what I got to do to make it ahead. And this is, you know, I mean, like, it seems to me that she has this like combination of hard-headed, but is able to get out of bed and dress herself every day, is able to sign a contract, is able, you know, so it's really hard to.
She's apparently able to negotiate a contract.
Negotiate a contract, clearly able to defend herself and get in arguments and fights and all that stuff. So
it's unfortunate.
I don't know. When Britney was going through a phase like this, right? Like there were interventions that were staged, but Azealia is working against an angry Black woman stereotype where people, when Black women act out in these ways, people don't see it as mental health issues. They don't see it as, oh, it seems like someone is really needing help. And Azealia has even talked about that and said, look, I really need help. I want to kill myself, has used this language. And no one sees it as vulnerability. Everyone sees it as aggression.
I wouldn't agree that no one sees it as vulnerability.
By and large, in the media that is written about her, it comes off as like she is this pariah. She is attacking people, whatever. I think that in small sort of progressive Black female circles, yeah, we see that and recognize that and understand that as vulnerability. But in the majority of what is written and said about her, no, I don't think that people see it as vulnerability. Even when she was on social media and had a Twitter account that was legitimate and verified, right? When she was acting out and, you know, T.I. even threatened to throw her down the stairs, right? Like, I mean, there was not this sense of like, oh, you're dealing with
And who are we talking about? That's T.I. But I think you might be rewriting history because Britney didn't have that level of sympathy while she was going through it. It did happen afterwards, after she was then, you know, put in to a facility and mm-hmm. came back and made some things. But this is a person, Azealia is very resistant to help. I think that has a large part to do with it. Anyway, moving on. Hall of Fame news came out this week. Rock Hall of Fame. The nominees for the class of 2017 came out. It's very exciting. The list includes Pearl Jam, Tupac Shakur, Depeche Mode, Electric Light Orchestra, Jane's Addiction, Janet Jackson, Journey, The Cars, The Zombies, Yes, Bad Brains, Chaka Khan, Sheet, J. Giles Band, Joan Baez, Joe Tex, Kraftwerk, MC5, and Steppenwolf. And for those of you interested, this year's class, in order to be eligible for this year's ballot, each nominee's first single or album had to be released in 1991 or earlier. meaning that this was the first year for Pearl Jam and Tupac Shakur to be eligible. And what's very interesting these days, fans also have a vote. So you can go to rollingstone.com to cast your vote if you want to vote. But what do you think about the list? I was kind of surprised because it is like Rock Hall of Fame. Now, Chaka Khan, I get that. But
yeah.
But Tupac?
They've been doing this. They put Run DMC in there too, right?
Yes.
And they've been doing this precisely because we don't, in hip hop, there isn't anything like the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. So they've been expanding their base. And really what they mean by rock and roll is popular culture and popular music. It's clear.
Maybe it's time for a name change then.
But then, you know, that would be an issue. I mean, because I think that part of what happens when these institutions are formed is that they're formed as ways of canonizing what is seen to be white culture. We know that rock and roll did not come. We know that. I said, that's why I said what is seen to be white culture. And I think that any movement to amend the name so that the name is, let's say, more inclusive of other genres, as the inductees are clearly from all kinds of genres.
Well, last year's Hall of Fame class included NWA, right? So.
Right. Yeah.
I'm still a bit, yeah.
Yeah. What they mean clearly is popular culture. And it's easier to say, well, hip hop is a subdivision of rock and roll than to say that hip hop is something else, right? Like
there was a time where there was more overlap, I think. And people have continued to try to do that overlap. In every decade, there was a type of overlap, right? There was a Limp Bizkit they were trying to do. There was a Linkin Park they were trying to do, like the rap guitar thing.
There was an Aerosmith Run DMC collaboration.
Right.
Back in the day.
Back in the 80s, you know, we had all those things.
There's a Lupe Fiasco situation. Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of things. Oops. Do I hear some Lupe resentment? But anyway, you know, there are a lot of different things that people have tried to come up with, but it clearly is its own genre. But rock and roll is always going to be called the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. You know, that's just what it's historically named as. But they really mean popular culture.
So are you going to cast a vote?
Girl, no.
Why not? You don't want to see Tupac, Chaka Khan, Janet? You don't want to see them inducted?
Okay, maybe you need to school me. What does it mean for them to be inducted?
Well, they get, you know, a plaque.
That's nice.
They get a little thing. There's a little ceremony in Brooklyn.
Ooh. I'm sure Janet needs that dinner. Go ahead. She's like, oh, what, chicken breast on the menu? No, I think they all eating okay. But okay, go ahead.
Wow. And I think it's a matter of, like, you know, how you go down in history, how your legacy is completed, how, for those who are still alive and making music, how they cut those future deals.
Definitely with Chaka Khan, because she has said repeatedly, she now lives in London, I believe, and she was as of a couple of years back. I know she did a tour recently, and she has said repeatedly that the American audience expects you to churn out music at a pace where if you haven't put out something in the last couple of years, they're not coming to see you. Whereas her European fan base, you know, and then a lot of jazz, hip hop artists have said this about Europe, that it's like you just need to put out that work of art that they connect to and they will always come out to see you. So definitely with artists that do not have, are not the kind of artists that are going to be churning out an album a year or an album every 2 years. I think that it's really good for them to have that under their belt, but I'm not a music industry person. I wouldn't know. I think it's nice historically to have Chaka Khan, Janet and Tupac in there. I'm really always skeptical of through inclusion, through organizations like the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame offering inclusion to certain diverse members in their list of who deserves to be in there. There's definitely the sense of like, okay, so now we can speak for this, right? Like, so now we can be the institutional body of who's who and who is worth what in the music industry. And I'm always like really skeptical of that. But yeah, I'm all for it. They should have been in there already. Look, I'm all for it. Definitely. Let them do it.
Cool. Step in. And since we're talking about, you know, dreams and visions and goals, I just have to throw a little shade because That's what I do. At Sierra, who was on Instagram this week talking about she has been, which is exciting, of course, she's been named the new global brand ambassador for Revlon. Why, though, did she say it was her long life dream? Can I understand that? I don't know.
Okay, so now I know that Sierra, your play wife, right? But Ben had said Sierra is beautiful basic. Let's be real. Beautiful basic. Sierra, you know, back in the day, I could totally see her as someone being like, girl, he took me to McDonald's, right? Like,
I no, really she wouldn't be like that. She would be like, girl, he took me to Chili's, the Applebee's, the
oh, TGIF no, he took me to the Cheesecake Factory.
There
boo.
You go. That's it.
Right. She would be excited
over it. Come on.
Okay. So take it up to the middle class. But you get what I'm saying. Like, she is beautiful, gorgeous, drop dead, whatever. But basic. Like, I fucked with Future and his three other baby mamas basic. Like, right. Okay. So I'm really glad that she got her good whatever going on with Mr. Godfearing or whatever. Right. Mr. Russell. And she, you know, doing the whole kind of heterosexual dream of getting married and, you know, love got to do, you know, love it. She having her moment. She dropped her defamation suit against Future, which is cool because she's making too much money to even claim she's been defamed, which is awesome, right? I'm glad that she's shining and doing her thing. But wasn't she named after a Revlon perfume? Right. Like, so, like, she come from a long line
wow.
of basicness. Like, she's a generational basic, right? Like, just it's in the DNA, boo. So, I love me, Sierra, and God bless her if that was her lifelong dream. Do you live your dream, Sierra? I think Revlon and that deal is awesome for you. And there's a also, a lot of speculation that she might be pregnant. We don't know. So, I mean, let her do her. Let her do it.
In our second segment, I would like to talk today about this beautiful spread that came out in the New York Times to the First Lady with love. So, four thank you notes to Michelle Obama, who has spent the past 8 years quietly and confidently changing the course of American history. Now, obviously, I love Michelle, but I'm still have to go in on what we saw. Let me start from the bottom. Four people, I'd like to know who picked them. No idea. So the fourth person was Rashida Jones. Rashida Jones is a writer. Let me finish. Thank you. Rashida Jones is a writer, actress, and producer who stars in the TBS comedy series Angie Tribeca. And she is Quincy Jones' daughter, for those of you who are wondering why she has such a Black name. Yes, she's Quincy Jones' daughter. And I have picked out excerpts from each letter to kind of show the essence of what everyone was writing about. And in hers, what I've picked out here is, quote, Michelle Obama embodies the modern American woman, and I don't mean that in any platitudinous or vague way. Rarely can someone express their many identities at the same time while seeming authentic. My female friends and I often talk about feeling like we are too much. We're complicated. We want to be so many things. I want to be a boss and also be vulnerable. I want to be outspoken and respected, but also sexy and beautiful. She goes on to write, Michelle Obama will have her own legacy separate from her husband's, and it will be that she was the first lady to show women that they don't have to choose, that it's okay to be everything. End quote. Next person. I don't know why this man was chosen. His name, John Meacham, a Pulitzer Prize winning biographer, is the author most recently of Destiny and Power, the American Odyssey of George Herbert Walker Bush. In the essence of his love letter, if you will, he writes, quote, there, in a way, was the essential Michelle Obama, or at least the essential observable version of herself. Speaking of broad public good, the garden, which was part of her campaign against childhood obesity, while revealing an arch sense of competitiveness. My husband won. He won twice. As their history-making time in the White House comes to an end, it's worth pondering the lessons of the age of Obama. My own view is that both the president and the first lady have conducted themselves splendidly in the White House, managing the most difficult of tasks with apparent ease, projecting a grace that masked the ambition and the drive that took them at early ages to the pinnacle of American life. He goes on to write, not everyone agrees, of course, not everyone ever does. The Obama skeptics and the Obama haters have from time to time questioned her patriotism, But this is the same country that managed in some quarters to hold Eleanor Roosevelt in contempt. The important thing is that Mrs. Obama, a clear-eyed lawyer, found a way to withstand the scrutiny of the spotlight. In point of fact, she did more than withstand it. To borrow a phrase from William Faulkner, she not only endured it, she prevailed over it. End quote. Then we also had Gloria Steinem, who's a feminist activist and writer. Most everyone knows her. She's been campaigning for Hillary Clinton and so on and so forth. Now, this person is truly known as a feminist. What I'd like to take from her love letter is, quote, after a decade under a public microscope, she has managed what no other first lady and few people in any public position have succeeded in doing. She has lived a public life without sacrificing her privacy and authenticity. She made her husband both more human and effective as a president by being his interpreter and defender, but also someone we knew was capable of being his critic. Eventually, she spoke up about the pain of the racist assumptions directed at her, but she waited until her husband could no longer be politically punished for her honesty. And she has always been the best kind of mother, which means insisting that fathers be equal parents. All of this she has done with honesty, humor, and most important, kindness. End quote. And the last of the four love letter writers was Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, who, of course, is the author of the novel Americana. And she has the book, well, they call it a book-length essay, We Should All Be Feminists. She was a recipient of the MacArthur Foundation Genius Grant, and so on and so forth. And she wrote the longest letter, and mostly interestingly. Her letter is written quite literary and goes on about style and whatnot. And I'll just read this part of it. Quote, she had become an American style icon. Her dresses and workouts, her carriage and curves, toned arms and long slender fingers, even her favored kitten heels for women who cannot fathom wearing shoes in the halfway house between flats and high heels, have earned a certain respect because of her. No public figure better embodies that mantra of full female selfhood. Wear what you like, end quote. So tell us about your disdain for these letters.
What do you say I have disdain for the letters? I think that...
Because you were just pointing at your mouth like you wanted to vomit. So.
I don't know how they chose these people. Like, who are these people? Like Gloria Steinem? Like, what is this? Like, why is she disdain? You know, she is, like, to me, white feminism embodied, not a hella an intersectional person. And the thing, you know, one of the commentators said it best, you know, the things that she tends to write about Black folks are always like super dry, terse, and like medical almost in their precision. Like, okay, how do I say this thing? It's clear that she doesn't have like a whole lot of cultural capital there. Chimamanda, I love. She's very interesting in the way that she blends like, you know, the implications of style with, you know, sort of like a feminism, which I think needs to be have some sort of like representation and articulation, which I think she does very well. So I don't know what Rashida Jones is talking about. And I don't know who that dude is. So I think that
really you like Chimamanda's
I get
most?
Where.
Wow.
Yeah. Just
and
because
why don't you know
like
what Rashida is talking about? Rashida is talking about the ability to be a lot of different things and not just one thing. What's wrong with that?
I'm not sure. I don't know. Like, that's not something that resonates with me. I'm not really sure. Maybe it's because I don't like Rashida. I don't know.
Do you have against Rashida?
Not a fan. I don't want to get into it right now, but I'm not a fan of Rashida Jones.
That sounds like you don't have a reason.
My reasoning is that, like, I think that that's a very particular thing to her. Like, I think that's her thing, right? Like, and that's fine. Because if Michelle Obama and the representation that Michelle Obama has given her and given women in general has empowered her in some way, by all means, let her do it. This idea that you can't be more than one thing, you, Quincy Jones' daughter, I don't really know, like, who's making you into a housewife? Who's making you into, like, only an actress? Who's... I don't really know. I feel like some of these wounds are self-inflicted. I don't know. The whole thing is just sort of an easy practice for me. I feel like I think it's great that Michelle Obama exists in the world and she has done what she's done in terms of representation for people and has been able to at least appear to bring her whole self to the table. I'm sure that, you know, when she writes her memoirs, there's some stuff that she's cutting out there. Because that's just the nature of the game, right? Like she has a public persona to uphold. So that's what's happening. But I think that there's something about the celebritification, right? The turning political actors into celebrities that really makes me very, very uneasy.
She's not a politician.
So uneasy.
She's never been a politician.
She is a political player. she's the First Lady of the United States. I do not see the level of influence that she has as apolitical. I do not see it. I do not see her as an apolitical person.
Then say she was apolitical, but you don't have to be a political figure to be political. She's not a politician.
I think that what Hillary, in her rise, is that your duties as a First Lady is not very different than your duties as a cabinet member in a lot of ways. You have a political purpose. You are there for a reason. People in the past have clearly not just elected presidents, they've elected couples. And the First Lady goes out there and she has a role. If it's a first man or whatever they call it, if it's a female president, then he will have a role. He's not going to just be at home baking cookies and talking to Martha Stewart. It's not going to happen. They have a political purpose. So I don't see her as anything but an extension of, in the political sense, right? The president.
I think she's actually a standalone. I don't see her as an extension of the president. She also did not get involved with policy as other past first ladies have. She had her own agendas that were not about policy. She wanted to get people moving. She was fighting against child obesity. She did quite a bit for veterans alongside Joe Biden's wife, the vice president's wife. I don't really see what the issue is in all of that with writing love letters to the First Lady. So First Lady, who has been under so much scrutiny, has been treated badly, has endured racist attacks, has been questioned as a parent. Why not have a positive side towards the end of this reign?
I'm not a New York Times editor, clearly, right? Like, I'm not saying that they shouldn't have run the piece. I said I'm uncomfortable with the celebrification of political players. That's what I'm uncomfortable with. And I'm uncomfortable with the focus on personality outside of policy. That's what I'm think that the attention given to Michelle Obama in general is about that too. I think that people want to write her love letters and she's doing something in terms of representation for them. I think that's great. I saw her latest speech. I think she's very effective, very political, having major political influence because of her position and her home in the White House. I see her as a politician in that sense, right? A lot of politicians are not elected. That's just how it is in the system. We're going to have to agree to disagree on that. She's really clear that, you know, she sees herself as a private citizen and, you know, feels like she's acting accordingly. That's fine. I just don't, and I appreciate her. None of this is about, you know, me being a Michelle Obama hater or I don't appreciate her skill and her style and all that good stuff. And I think that the kind of hate that she gets, absolutely racist, absolutely sexist, totally whack. I just think, you know, I don't really understand what all of this is about. It's lost on me.
In our third segment, what are we looking forward to? What are we excited about? Let's hear it.
Okay, so there are a few things coming up in Vienna. Some of you may know that in Berlin, there's a festival. And some of those films have made it to Vienna. And there's going to be a showing of that at Dual at the WTFAG, which is like a queer party. And they're going to be showing some of those. The Viennale is coming up, which is amazing. So it's kind of Vienna's version of the Berlinale. So there are going to be a suite of films. A lot of them are really good. Two artists are performing that I mentioned. Yasin Bey, formerly known as Mos Def, turns out this is his very last tour. According to him, he is retiring from the music industry. And so it's my last opportunity to see him live. Luckily, I got advanced tickets. He has postponed his show by, I think, about a week. But luckily, I'll still be in town and there to see it. And then as a bonus, Saul Williams is coming through and I'm going to be seeing him, which is exciting. So it's going to be a twofer. And on Friday night, as an after party for the Viennale, there is 5 years of Fair Le Funk is presenting the Tall Black Guy, who's an amazing DJ, electronica, does really good work out of Chicago. So I'm really excited about seeing him. So there's a lot of cultural amazing stuff coming through Vienna this week that people should check out. What are you looking forward to?
Well, I'm excited still about Insecure. I watched the second episode. I still completely think it's a great show. I don't see any of the critique that was coming out about the angry and bitter, successful Black woman. I love the second episode. The soundtrack is fire. So I'm still really excited. I am looking forward to teaching some yoga and mindfulness tonight at a Black History Month event here in London. A mental health charity reached out to me and asked me if I would do that. They're doing kind of a historical setting for like the local Black history culture in that borough in that district. And it looks like it's going to be a great event with a lot of different things going on. The venue or the charity is called Cool Tan Arts. If you're interested and you're in London, you should check them out. Other than that, though, I hope to have a fairly chill weekend after last weekend running to just about every event possible. This weekend has a lot less to offer. Next weekend will be all the way turned up again. So yoga, mindfulness, coming into the present, setting intentions for the new season, these types of things. Well, that's all for this week. If you would like to keep up with us, you can follow us on Twitter at The Queer Truth. We'd love to hear your thoughts on some of the things we've discussed today, so feel free to get at us. Also, if you'd like to donate a dollar or two to our Patreon site, you can find us on Patreon, patreon.com/TheQueerTruth. Until next time, peace out.